Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of the Bay Area Performing Arts. I'm your host, David LaTulip. This week, well, sort of a PG-13 version of Open Air, as I'll be talking with Darcy Drolinger, writer, director, and one of the stars in, how should we say this, Poop and Champagne, a whitesploitation comedy with dance at the new space, The Oasis. Also, actors Will Jamona and Chris Morrell, two of the actors in the new Conservatory Theater production of Avenue Q, sort of Sesame Street's for adults, stop by. And I'll be talking with John Fisher, who will share his vision of The Anarchist by David Mamet, currently at Theater Rhino. And before the hour's up, Peter Robinson will be by to offer a couple of movie reviews and a tribute to the late, great Joe Cocker. Stay with us. It would be indeed a pleasure to convey on the airwaves the alliterative pleasure of the title of the current show at The Oasis, a brand new club entertainment venue in the Mission, but FCC regulations prohibit me from doing so. So I'll attempt a compromise that doesn't require a censor's beep. When I say schist, I really mean another word for poop. Schist and Champagne, a white exploitation comedy with dance, is directed and stars Darcy Drolinger, a multimedia artist whose own original works include Mr. Irresistible, Project Lohan, Scalpel, The Possession of Mrs. Jones, Pink Elephants, and Above and Beyond the Valley of the Ultra Showgirls, among others. Darcy has also worked as an actor, producer, director, and choreographer on and off Broadway, and he's the creator of Sexitude, trademark, the body-positive, age-positive, sex-positive dance experience based here in San Francisco. His newest venture, where S and Champagne is being performed, The Oasis, is a 6,000-square-foot performance space in the heart of San Francisco's SoMa district. Darcy, welcome. I'm so happy that you could take some time today.
Thank you, thank you.
And in street clothes, I see.
Yes, you know, going into this, I realized that I'll probably be in drag for the next year doing this club, so... Maybe the last time you can see me like this.
Well, let's get right down to the then about the show. You're performing in drag. Some of the photos are absolutely, might I say, gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
Really, so that must take a lot of work.
You know, it is a process. Granted, photos nowadays can be touched up a little. And Matthew Anderson, who did a lot of those photos, is a genius. But yes, you know, it's a good 2-hour process.
Oh my gosh. Well, let's talk about your character. Your character is called Champagne Horowitz Jones Dickerson White.
She's been married a couple of times, but that's none of your business, which is a line we use over and over in the show. And she's basically the equivalent of Foxy Brown. You know, I set out to do kind of a send-up of exploitation and blaxploitation films. But you know, with a white girl, so hence the whitesploitation. And when I search for a lot of derogatory white terms, they often refer to her as a steamy plate of vanilla pudding and things like that. Some people lately have been calling it a dragsploitation too, which I think is very funny.
Nice. Does this come from a personal obsession with yours of the 70s and 80s
whitesploitation
film?
I was a
play on blaxploitation.
I'm a product of the 70s, and you know, it very much plays with not only those low-budget 70s films, but it also spoofs a lot of the television shows, Wonder Woman, Charlie's Angels.
Ripe for the spoofing.
Yes, exactly. You know, there's a lot of going undercover, you know, where she'll put her hair in a bun and wear some glasses and she's a scientist. Actually, she's a nuclear physicist's assistant's assistant, you know. So it's all very Mel Brooks slapstick, you know, like Airplane, the movie, that kind of humor. But surprisingly, you know, you talk about drag and you talk about the camp value, but if you really break it down, it's very much classic farce or commedia, where there's all these archetypes, and we really, it looks like an almost improvisational show, but my poor actors have so much memorization and so many quick changes that it is, it's a challenging show. At one point, we were trying to do two shows a night, and everyone's like, no, please.
Oh, my gosh. So you mentioned this is not a one-man show by any means. Talk about the rest of your cast. Great names there. I mean, Matthew Martin's been around for some time.
Matthew Martin is amazing.
Listeners should note that it's not the Matthew Martin who's the general manager of KLW Radio. No. Disclaimer.
It's Matthew Martin, one of the very best Betty Davis impersonators in the world, in my
opinion. I've seen Matt do Betty Davis.
Yeah. Just amazing. So, but
I meant our Matt.
Oh, you're Matt too. We'll put him head to head. You know, and this I think has been fun for Matthew to play a villain. He plays Dixie Stampede. She's the super villain. She's also the president of Mallwart.
Gosh, what are you exploiting there?
Exactly. And, you know, a little other fun, and my other cast members are great too. Stephen LeMay is hilarious as Brandy White, Champagne's adopted half-stepsister. And James Arthur as the sassy sidekick, Nancy French as the old bitter stripper, Debbie, and Adam Roy as Detective Jack Hammer. So it's got a little bit of hard-boiled stuff going on in there as well. And a funny story the name didn't just come out of nowhere. It was these kind of movies are always have the same formula where this innocent woman gets involved in a drug ring. It's got everyone addicted to heroin, and then they become prostitutes, and then they kill her relative and lover, and then she's got to extract revenge.
A Quinn Martin production.
Exactly. But I was I can make them all heroin addicts, but that's not that funny. And then so I was reading in the Village Voice the same week I was writing this, or started writing it, and Michael Musto had a column about all the nightclubs' sewer systems backing up during the evening because people were doing booty bumps and shooting crystal meth up there and defecating in their pants and actually flushing their underwear down the toilets.
Oh, brother.
And I thought, okay, well, they won't be heroin addicts. They'll be booty bump addicts. And hence the name came out of that.
I see. Schist and Champagne. Yes.
Yes. And that is, and also, it is also very much theater of the absurd. So title, yes.
There's lots of dancing involved, I understand.
Yes. So throughout the show, we break into choreographed dance numbers, which, again, adds to another level of ridiculousness and also almost creates these little, like, 1 to 2 minute mini drag shows throughout the course of the play, which in and of itself is almost vaudevillian in the fact that people chant along. You know, every time she says her name, the people, we call them schist heads, who come over and over and over, and they chant along. So they'll say Champagne, Horowitz, Jones. They'll say the whole thing.
It's almost like a Rocky Horror Picture Show sort of experience.
It is, and it's very immersive. When we invite four people that we know, or other actors, or people that want a free ticket to come down and dress up as bad strippers, and we've built four stripper poles. And so if you come for the first half hour, you can watch some terrible pole dancing by fabulous drag queens, men, women, and they get a free ticket and keep their tips. Oh, so that's
keep,
a nice...
Keep their tip. Was that tip? T-I-P-S. Okay,
yes,
good.
They
All
get
right,
to
good.
Keep their tips.
All right, good.
So, yeah. And, you know, we did this before last year at a bar called Rebel. When that closed, you know, it really pushed us to move quicker in opening a new space. And really wanted to continue this run and being able to put it on a 30-foot stage versus a 12-foot stage and be able, you know, open the room up has been such a joy to actually see the show come to life, how it was should have been realized, you know, in any one of its incarnations. I mean, I did this in New York before as well, too, but I feel like it's now really finally hitting its stride.
It's Darcy Drollinger, star and director of Schist and Champagne at the new performance space, The Oasis. Now, you mentioned that this has been in other places, but it fits rather nicely in The Oasis. But tell us about this venture of that you're very much involved in called The Oasis. It's a new space.
It is a brand new space, and which is exciting in a time where so many places, there's all we hear are stories of places closing. To have something that is truly, I think, San Franciscan and coming up from the underground, getting to open.
It has quite a history, the space itself.
The space itself has a history. It was originally just a swimming pool with cinder block walls around it, and it was a bathhouse. It was a gay bathhouse, and then it was the Drummer Key Club, a private leather sex club. And in those days, we found some old posters. Admission was $1 and a six-pack of beer to get in.
If those walls could talk.
I know.
Yeah.
And then it was called The Plunge, and then it was Dirty Sally's, and then it became The Oasis, and they put a plexiglass.
You seem to know an awful lot about these different incarnations.
Well, actually, we did our research when we got into it, but it's been a lot of things. And, you know, frankly, we've been working on trying to put the space together for about 2 years. And I'm doing this with Heklina, who used to do Tranny Shack and now is starting a new weekly drag show called Mother. There'll be our Saturday night kind of tentpole. Yes. anyway, I also am working with two other great partners, Jason Bebote and Jeff Benjamin, who have been working their fingers to the bone to get us to today, which is really the first. We had a New Year's Eve party, but today is the opening where we are open now 7 days a week starting today at 6 o'clock. So it is a nightclub, cabaret, and theater. So we have a beautiful proscenium stage built by Sarah Pikett from ACT. We have a main room that's 4,500 square feet. We're going to be doing everything from theatrical shows to cabaret. We got a really cool old Steinway Baby Grand.
Nice, nice.
We want to offer cabaret acts that maybe don't quite fit into Feinstein's or something that we can offer a cheaper ticket price to younger people that want to go see cabaret. Of course, want to have all the drag queens from around the country come. Be a little more like Josie's Juice Joint used to be. As well as having the big parties. We have some dance parties every Friday night. We do an early show and a late show. Mother will be every Saturday night. And also really incubate new work. We have a smaller stage in one room where we want to offer that to people who are starting out. Build an audience, then move them into the big room. I think there's a
move
huge
to the deep end of the pool,
exactly,
so to speak, even though there's no pool anymore.
You know, coming from New York, I realized there was no space like this, really. You know, we can seat up 140 to 170 people. And creating a kind of clubhouse for San Francisco audiences and performers, as well as out-of-town audience and performers. So
Oasis is at 298 11th Street at Folsom Street. You can see some great clips from Schist and Champagne at their website, sfoasis.com. Darcy Drollinger starring as Champagne Horowitz Jones Dickerson White. I love it. I hope to see it. I encourage others to do so as well. Again, sfoasis.com. Darcy, thanks for coming
thanks
in
so
today.
Much.
Still to come, a talk with John Fisher about David Mamet. A couple of the actors from Avenue Q at the new conservatory will be by. And Peter Robinson will be by with a couple of movie reviews and a remembrance of Joe Cocker. Theater Rhinoceros is midway through the run of the West Coast premiere of The Anarchist by David Mamet, directed by John Fisher. The Anarchist is a psychological drama about a lesbian anarchist. On the day of her possible parole and her battles with a prison psychologist, the woman who holds the key to her freedom. David Mamet and Theater Rhino and director John Fisher, who joins me today, have a unique history. John Fisher directed the Theater Rhinoceros production of Mamet's Boston Marriage in its Bay Area premiere in 2006. He wrote an undergraduate thesis at UC Berkeley on Mamet. And in addition, Michael Hausman, Mamet's film producer, produced John Fisher's first New York City show, Tangled Versions of the Truth. Most recently, John's play To Sleep and Dream won the 2014 Bay Area Critics Circle Award for Best Original Script, and his 2014 production of Alan Bennett's The Habit of Art was nominated for 3 TBA Awards, including Best Production of a Play. A pleasure to welcome back to our airwaves once again, Mr. John Fisher.
Thanks, David.
Nice to see you, man.
It's great to be here.
So let's first talk to us about David Mamet. You wrote a thesis on him, so you must know just about everything.
I don't know everything.
All right. Well, what's your fascination with him?
Well, he's a big force in the American theater. When I was in college, him and Sam Shepard were the big voices, and I was always attracted to his plays because of language and also the naughtiness. I mean, you know, he knows every four-letter word ever created and created a few himself, and I thought that was fascinating when I was in college. And so I've been on this kind of lifelong journey following his career. And as a playwright, he's always inspired me a lot, too.
Mm-hmm. And so you're bringing this production here to San Francisco, even though the New York production had not such a great review and closed fairly quickly. Has the show itself, the play itself, been retooled for the West Coast premiere?
No, it's the same play. I think I approached it differently. He directed his own production, and I think I've tried to open it up and let the actors really have fun with the text. I don't know if you know about David Mamet's acting style.
Well, let's talk about that, actor. Please.
Well, it's very simple. You're just supposed to say the words. He's a playwright. He doesn't want actors interfering with his material. We've taken a much more open view of things and let the actors really explore the characters and kind of bring the play to life and present it in a way that I think is a lot more dramatically exciting than maybe it had been originally.
Let's talk a little bit about the plot itself. I had a brief introduction, but what is The Anarchist all about?
It takes its inspiration from the Weather Underground and their attack on the Brinks armored car in 1981, which was a sort of a end of the 60s radical movement, I think. I think things had sort of reached a point where violence was becoming more and more a part of radicalism. And the Brinks armored car robbery was this big event with the Black Liberation Army and the Weather Underground, where they knocked off this Brinks armored car and a lot of people got killed. And they all went to jail. And he's taken this as the inspiration for this exploration of the American state and American radicalism and a dialogue between the two and what in a democracy is important with regards to freedom and what is also important with regards to social control. So it's a debate play where the audience really decides who is right.
Who are the actors then, and what characters are they portraying?
Valina Brown, famous from the SF Mime Troupe, is playing Anne, who represents the state. And Tamara Cohn, who's been a lot of our Theater Rhinoceros productions, she's playing Kathy, who is the anarchist. Some say based on Kathy Boudin, who was in jail for 20 years for this same robbery and is now a professor at Columbia.
Hmm.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And what are we going to see on the stage then? Are you recreating some sort of the imagery of that actual
event? Actually, no. It's an 85-minute play. There's one scene, and it is literally the debate between the two women about whether or not this woman's going to get paroled. And it's a real battle of wills. It's a very exciting production. It's amazing to watch these two actresses go at it. I think the audience is in shock that the lights don't black out. They just keep going at each other. And at the end, a resolution is reached. And it's a shocking play in that it's so thick in ideas and the actresses are so immersed in their characters. It's almost like nothing else you ever see on stage because it's pretty much unrelenting, extremely involving. And we have audience on stage. We have an onstage jury, 12 peers. And they're very much a visible part of the action as well.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, I'm talking with John Fisher, who's directing The Anarchist by David Mamet at the Eureka Theater, 215 Jackson Street, runs through January 17th, therhino.org for more information. Now, David Mamet himself offered you some personal encouragement back in 2006. Have you been in touch with him about this particular production?
He saw a play of mine, and he was standing in the shadows, you know, at intermission, and I went up and said hi, and he, you know, I was kind of terrified of him, you know. He's sort of a horrifying man,
you certainly studied him, you might know that.
He's wonderful, but I'm intimidated by everybody. But anyway, I went over and said hi, and he was actually very sweet. He actually complimented me on some things that I think only a director or another director would notice. And I think he was just being nice, but he did go out of his way, I felt, to point up some things that I'd done with that particular production. And which meant a lot to me at the time. I was like 21, you know. Somebody important was nice enough to say something nice to me.
And now at 25, you're directing.
I know. It's been 4 long years, and I've come a long way. And I think it shows. I think it shows on my face, my hairline.
Did he have any input at all on your particular production of this?
No, I think he was happy to see it happen. I think he really believes in his script, as all playwrights do. And I think he was, you know, I think frustrated by the response in New York, which was sort of savage and not necessarily appropriate. But and I think he's happy to see it being done. I think he's also tickled by the fact that a queer theater is interested in his work. He's such a macho playwright, of all things. And we've done 3 of his shows, and it's a copacetic relationship. I'm thrilled that in his development since I studied him as an undergraduate, he's evinced a great interest in queer lives and is very sympathetic, I think, in his portrayals.
Well, you're with your Wikipedia-like knowledge of Mamet, then how does The Anarchist compare to other Mamet plays? Is this a development? Is this a change of pace? Or?
I think for a long time, you think of plays like American Buffalo, he was interested in character and interaction and language. Now he's interested in plot. This has a lot of plot. It's a fascinating story, following what happened in the past and what's happening in front of us as they debate the past. Mamet has really grown, I feel, from being a man who basically wrote in a Beckettian manner or a Harold Pinter-inspired manner where language was paramount, to now being a playwright still obsessed with language and interaction, but also with plot. How thick can you make a plot? How dense? It's almost like The Sting, his plots. They keep unraveling in surprising, exciting ways. I think he's grown immensely as a playwright. And also, as I say, his sympathy for these characters, I think, is very touching. And he has a humanity about him, which is surprising from the man who is famous for the four-letter word and guys kind of hanging out. And this is a play with no men. It's all women.
And how is his writing for lesbians, then?
Well, they sound like men. I mean, you know, it's somehow it all kind of works. He writes, as I say, he writes for humans. He writes for people. Uh-huh. It's very believable. What's most believable is the way people don't let each other off the hook, the way they really listen to each other so they can hear what each other are saying so they can respond. It sounds like two incredible attorneys arguing a case. And how do they reach a consensus? Agreement, even with so much philosophical disparity between them.
So not only an entertaining evening of theater, but something that's really going to make you think and give your brain a bit.
It's very provocative. I think his influences in this case are Ibsen, Shaw, really trying to explore a profound, important issue for the polity in a rich way and still keep it entertaining, still keep it fun. It's a challenge of all theater.
The Anarchist runs through January 17th at the Eureka Theater on Jackson Street downtown. Information at therhino.org. John, what's coming up next for you and for Theater Rhino?
We're doing a play, Breaking the Code, about Alan Turing. And it's a wonderful play. It's about his science and his sexuality. And the playwright, Hugh Whitemore, is a beautiful play. He's
timely, I mean, given the film that's happened.
Yeah, and this is a 30-year-old play. And it really draws on himself as an outsider. It shows him his sexuality made him outsider, but that made him think differently, which is what allowed him to break the German U-boat code and basically win the Second World War. And I love that equation between the uniqueness of homosexuality and the uniqueness of a brain, of a great brain like Turing's. And that's what the play is so strong about, equating the two and bringing those aspects of his personality together.
Well, John Fisher, we look forward to having you on to perhaps talk about that down the road.
That's great, David. We'd love to.
And I wish you a very excellent rest of the run of Theater Rhinoceros West Coast premiere of The Anarchist by David Mamet. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, David.
What do you do with the BA in English? What is my life going to be? 4 years of college and plenty of knowledge have earned me this useless degree. I can't pay the bills yet, 'cause I have no skills yet. The world is a big scary place, but somehow I can't shake the feeling I might make a difference to the human race.
Morning, Brian.
Hi, Cake Monster.
How's life?
Disappointing.
What's the matter?
The catering company laid me off.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Me too. I mean, look at me. I'm 10 years out of college, and I always thought, oh.
What?
No, it sounds stupid.
Aw, come on.
When I was little, I thought I would be
what?
A big comedian on late night TV.
Oh.
But now I'm 32, and as you can see, I'm not.
Nope.
Oh, well.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks to be me.
No.
It sucks to be me.
No.
It sucks to be broke and unemployed and turning 33. It sucks to be me.
You think your life sucks?
It Sucks to Be Me from the Avenue Q musical, 2003 Tony Award Triple Crown winner, best musical, best book, best score, sung by the character Princeton, among others, upon arriving at his potential apartment on Avenue Q because he couldn't afford to live on the pricier blocks further back on the alphabet. Avenue Q has been termed Sesame Street for adults, with adult dilemmas like exasperating roommates, addiction to internet porn, and one-night stands. I'm pleased to welcome a couple of the cast members of the show. Currently in a sold-out run at the New Conservatory Theater, Will Jamona, who plays Princeton and Rod, and Chris Morrell, who plays Trekkie Monster and Nikki. Chris, welcome to Open Air.
Oh, thank you, David.
It's such a pleasure to have you guys on. I'm a bit hesitant to express my enthusiasm for the show because you're sold out. There's maybe two seats left now through February 1st.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Congratulations.
Get on that website pretty fast.
Congratulations on that. I mean, everyone has really responded. And it's not the first time the show has come to San Francisco either.
That's correct. Yeah, we had a run last year that also sold out, I believe, actually before our opening night even came along.
Well, so that brings me to my first question. Have either of you done the show before?
We were both part of the cast last year as well, so we're actually part of this remount in the second generation of Avenue Q at New Conservatory for this year.
Nice, and both in the same characters.
Yes. That is correct, yeah.
Now, you guys are just amazing as multitaskers in the production, which needs some explanation for those who don't know what the show's actors have to go through. Why don't you share with us how this show is somewhat different than just a couple of actors on stage?
Sure. So the cast is seven people. There are three people who play humans. So there's a kind of guy down on his luck, Brian, who can't really hold down much of a job. His fiance, Christmas Eve, who is a budding psychotherapist, and Gary Coleman, who is the super for the apartment building in which they all live.
That's just a riot in itself. Why is Gary Coleman the super of this building?
Yeah, well, he's a bit down on his luck, too,
yeah, exactly.
As you'll find many of the characters in this particular neighborhood are.
So those three characters are the same. Those actors play those characters for the entire role. Yeah.
Now we need to talk about the puppetry involved, because mm-hmm. there's live action as well as puppetry, and you're doing singing as well. So right.
Yeah, so there's four other actors who play all the other puppets. And like I said, I play Princeton and Rod, and Chris plays Trekkie and Nikki.
And a couple additional, actually. I also play a Bad Idea Bear a newcomer at the end. And there are two other puppeteers who cover. One is Kate and Lucy, the slut. Pardon my Francais. That is her
it's
name.
Better
though.
Than schist and champagne. Yeah, yeah. I think we're okay with slut.
Oh, good, good, excellent. And then we have an additional puppeteer who operates literally every single puppet except for one, which I imagine totals somewhere around 12 characters.
But what's different in this than, say, Sesame Street is that in Sesame Street and in the Muppets, the actors who are doing the puppeteering are not seen. So this is a little bit different in the sense that when we are holding our puppet, I've got Princeton up next to me. I'm seen just as well as Princeton, and I'm wearing all black, but my face is still emoting as the emotions of Princeton, and I'm still voicing Princeton and singing as Princeton and moving Princeton around.
I'm lucky to have caught the show, and again, there might be some waiting list availability for tickets for people that are intrigued by the show itself. But you're kind of, it's not that you're distracted. You're involved with both, as an audience member, you're involved with both the puppeteer and the puppet itself. It's a fascinating show.
Yeah, well, we have our puppet master to thank for that. Her name is Allison Daniels, and she's done an excellent job with fine-tuning us, and luckily we've had the benefit of now working with her over the course of, probably 4 months of training throughout the two different rehearsal processes.
Was she involved in the earlier last year's production?
She was, yes. And she's also done some other puppetry work with New Conservatory Theater. In fact, I've worked with her on one other show that involved some other live hand manipulations and I can't remember where the location is, but they have shadow puppets.
Balinese.
Japan. Yeah, Balinese.
Balinese,
yes,
okay.
That's right.
Yeah, it was interesting because when we first started working on it, Allison was a little resistant to doing puppetry where the puppeteer was visibly seen. That was kind of different for her, and it kind of goes against a lot of kind of more traditional puppetry kind of thoughts and methodology. But it started to become something that the actor and the puppet kind of merged together in the audience's mind. We've heard this a lot over and over from our audiences where they continue to look at the puppet, but they somehow absorb the emotional content that we're putting out on our faces as well, because the puppet faces are not that malleable. They can open their mouths and that's about it. They can't move their eyes. They can't, do anything else.
Yeah, everything's fixed, really.
So it ends up that the audience somehow kind of blends the two faces together in creating this kind of combination of my face and Princeton, for example, to kind of figure out what Princeton's going through.
And I think the space also helps with that because it's not a huge house. It's a little bit of an intimate theater. So I think even there's not really a bad seat in the house. Even from the back row, you can see what's happening on the puppeteers' faces pretty excellently, I would say.
That's true. Now, having been there, the theater is a wonderful intimate space. A couple of the puppets involve a second body helping you manipulate. Can you talk about that, Chris?
My additional puppeteer arm is manipulated by Haley Nystrom.
And why is that?
Well, he has two arms, this puppet Nikki, as well as Trekkie Monster. They're what's called live hand puppets. So the hands are literally our hands, my left hand, her right hand, and my right hand is operating his mouth at the same time. So everywhere that she goes, she is literally attached to me at the waist. She's got her arm around me, and we cannot literally take more than one step without being pulled together again. And it actually is a fabulous illusion. We're very simpatico, and she's able to sync up with all the movements very nicely, and it really just looks like one entity, one person, one giant huge puppet, but very intricately operated by two people.
We should mention a little bit about Trekkie Monster, especially. We won't play the cut for those of it.
Yeah.
One of his big numbers is the internet is for porn.
Yes.
And yes,
that is correct.
And porn. Because the idea behind that is there's a very idealistic school teacher, Kate Monster, who's saying how one can learn all kinds of interesting things on the internet, like, the population of some sort of fun fact.
And of course, porn. The internet is very, very great for porn, according to him.
Thank you for that. It's just clever, yes. Of course, just the character.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, no, I mean,
we would know nothing about that.
No, of course not. But he's quite the expert on it, I would say.
Chris Morell playing Trekkie Monster and Nikki, who is the roommate of Rod. Now, Rod, talk to us about Rod and Nikki. They're kind of a playoff of Bert and Ernie very much so. I'm surprised they got away with the parody so well.
Yeah, it's very a loving parody. I think that's how they get away with it. Yeah, very much. Rod is very much Bert, and Nikki's very much Ernie. The difference here is that Bert is a closeted Republican who is very much in love.
Rod.
Sorry, did I say Bert? Bert may be too, actually. I can't say that Bert is not. Can neither confirm nor deny. Rod is a closeted Republican.
Write your letters to KALW, 500 Mansell Street, San Francisco, 94134.
So, yes, Rod is a closeted Republican who is in love with his roommate, Nikki, and over the course of the play comes to grips with that and resolves that very easily. Yes.
And I do need to mention, I believe you both double, or one of you doubles with one of the characters called the Bad Idea Bears.
Yes.
Talk to us about the Bad Idea Bears. What is that?
Everybody knows the Bad Idea Bears without introduction. They appear kind of like the angel or the devil on your shoulder, except no angel.
Yeah.
And they give you some really excellent life advice, how you should definitely celebrate small victories in life by buying cases of beer.
Right, but because it's so much more economical than buying a six-pack, and you're limited on your money, so you want to get the most bang for it.
Yeah, that's right. You're wasting money in the long run if you don't buy in bulk.
I don't consider that a bad idea.
It's
actually
a great idea, especially for, you know, a young man who's not got all the money in the coffers for a beer here and there.
We should give a shout out to your co-stars. You mentioned Sam Jackson as Gary Coleman.
Oh, actually, that was last year's production.
Oh, okay.
Gary Coleman is this year played by Paige Mays.
All right, then maybe I have a different name too. Who is Brian and Christmas Eve?
Zach Schumann plays Brian, and Teresa Attridge plays Christmas Eve. They're also returning. The only other new castmate is Haley Nystrom, replacing Millie DeBenedet as the auxiliary puppeteer.
We mentioned Christmas Eve, the angry, aggressive psychotherapist with a thick Japanese accent. Her tune is just amazing. She's married to this lug of a guy, and her song is "The More You Rub Someone, the More You Want to Cure Him."
That's right. She's got a wonderful accent that she has lovingly, without any sort of offensiveness in her heart, crafted to portray this character. It's wonderful.
I'd love to share some of the racier moments on the air with listeners, like "The Internet is for Poor" and "Everyone's a Bit Racist."
Yes.
A marvelous tune. Very incredibly crafted stuff by Robert Lopez's music. Mm-hmm. And "Schadenfreude," another great tune. But there's also a beautiful ballad sung by the character Kate Monster, so perhaps that's the way to go out.
Yeah.
Set up, there's a fine line for me, would you?
Sure. Will. So Kate Monster and Princeton, my character, have had a budding relationship. And Princeton, at another wedding, they go to a wedding together as a date. And he has a bit of a freak out moment where he thinks that his purpose in life needs to be to propose and get married and do the kind of things that hurry you along in life cycle. And he ends up, unfortunately, breaking up with her, and she decides that, she needs to stop wasting her time with people who are going to waste her time. So it's a fine line between love and a waste of time.
Will Jamona, who plays Princeton and Rod, Chris Morrell, Trekkie Monster, and Nikki, I wish you a wonderful run. It's already a sold-out run. Avenue Q runs through February 1st at the Decker Theater, New Conservatory Theater Center on Van Ness Off Market. Maybe two tickets left. Maybe you can get on a waiting list. Details at nctcsf.org. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
An afternoon alone with my favorite book, Broadway Musicals of the 1940s. No roommate to bother me. How could it get any better than this?
Oh, hi, Rod!
Hi, Nikki.
Hey, Rod, you'll never guess what happened to me on the subway this morning. This guy was smiling at me and talking to me.
Mm, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
He was being real friendly, and I think he was coming on to me. I think he might have thought I was gay.
So why are you telling me this? Why should I care? I don't care. What'd you have for lunch today?
Well, you don't have to get all defensive, Rod.
Why do I care about some gay guy you met, okay? I am trying to read.
Well, I didn't mean anything by it, Rod. I just think it's something we should be able to talk about.
Well, I do not want to talk about it, Nikki. This conversation is over.
Yeah, but Rod...
Over!
Well, okay. But just so you know, if you were gay, that'd be okay. I mean, 'cause, hey... I'd like you anyway, because you see, if it were me, I would feel free to say that I was gay, but I'm not gay.
Nikki, please, are you trying to read? What?
If you were queer,
Nikki,
I'd still be here.
Nikki, I am trying to read this book.
Year after year,
Nikki.
Because you're dear to me, and I know that you
what?
Would accept me too.
I would?
If I told you today.
Hey, guess what? I'm gay.
But I'm not gay. I'm happy just being with you.
I buy the shoes, pal Joey.
So what should it matter to me what you do in bed with guys?
Hey, that is wrong.
No, it's not. If you were gay, I'd shout, hooray!
I am not listening.
And here I'd stay. But I wouldn't get in your way. You can count on me to always be beside you every day to tell you it's okay. You were just born that way. And as they say, it's in your DNA. You're gay. If you were gay.
From Avenue Q, If You Were Gay. The production at the New Conservatory Theater through February 1st is sold out. You might be able to get on a waiting list or some return tickets, nctcsf.org, for more details. Worth doing. A great show to catch. Unmistakable voice of Joe Cocker. Here with a remembrance of the great Joe Cocker is our critic at large, Peter Robinson. Hi, Peter. Thanks.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And indeed, the gravelly, croaky voice of Joe Cocker, who died just before Christmas, aged 70, and rated by many people as one of the greatest white blues and soul vocalists. The version we've been listening to, of course, appeared on a Beatles album, and the Beatles themselves really praised his rendition. It was a contrast to their own kind of music hall, cheerful arrangement of "We'll Get By With a Little Bit of Help from Our Friends." And then, of course, he would go on to Woodstock and again turn it into a great rock and roll number. My memory of Joe Cocker, because I met him in the late 60s, was on a rainy night in Sheffield. He grew up in Sheffield, and like many of the rock musicians who would come over to this country, he actually started singing skiffle. And not a lot of people may know what skiffle music is. It seems to be a lost era from the 1950s, which involved washboards, homemade kind of basses, a piece of wood with string which you plucked, and maybe a can which you drummed. That was skiffle. And then from skiffle came what would be, in the end, this star's masterpiece, which was this tough, grouchy, almost shouting type of blues singing. But also for Joe Cocker, he had the other side when it came to ballads. And in a movie which came out in the 80s, The Officer and Gentleman, he would sing Up There Where We Belong with Jennifer Warner, and you'd almost hear a softer, more gentle side. So I think he's one of those interesting contrasts where you've got the tough master performer and then you've got the more gentle side, and somehow he brought these two together. I don't want to use the word schizophrenia, but certainly he crossed a number of different lines. He was also part of the, I use the phrase in its cliched sense, drugs, sex, rock and roll, and went through the 70s with many different problems. But he was a survivor. The industry always loved him. And a couple of interesting songs, which we don't often hear nowadays, is You Can Leave Your Hat On. It's an unusual song because it was originally based on a Randy Newman number, a kind of sly form of voyeurism, but in fact people have suggested it really related to Kim Basinger doing a strip act at one of Mickey Rourke's parties, of which he reminded her, yes, but you can keep your hat on, which, of course, leaves that to the imagination.
Indeed. Appropriate for today's show. I mean, we've been all over PG-13 territory.
Okay.
Moving into the R, I think.
So look for different things in Joe Cocker, and don't just remember him as that gravelly voice. But in the end, I think the gravelly voice accounts for his survival, because as you get older, that tougher type of voice just seems to develop depth of quality. And it's not comparable, but it reminds me a little bit of Louis Armstrong and that sort of scat singing where you're coming from deep down in your throat, you're projecting a sound. And of course, in Joe Cocker's case, you've got the whole performance to go with it.
In the Leonard Cohen style as well, in terms of his deep, gravelly voice. It's almost like the Cookie Monster singing to you.
Yeah, singing and wooing you and leaving you out there wondering what's going to happen next. As he developed, he became part of what I call the more civilized scene, and he was involved in fundraising for a number of royal family trusts. It's ironic because earlier at one performance, he'd been introduced to Princess Anne. This is when he was pretty high, and he confused her for his girlfriend and was only, in fact, reminded about it when two policemen escorted him at a goodly distance from the princess. But he's gone now. But to me, he still remains the unhouse-trained performer on stage, a man who turned what I call white blues singing around, a voice which is still with us. Yes, that's Joe Cocker, and indeed we'll get by, but it'll be a little loss because we won't have him and his friends anymore.
Let's hear a little bit more of Joe Cocker than a couple of movie reviews from Peter Robinson, as we remember Joe Cocker most likely.
So beautiful. So beautiful. To me, can't you see? You're everything I hope for. Yeah.
Of the late, great Joe Cocker from a live recording, remembered by critic at large, Peter Robson. Thank you for that, Peter.
Thank you, David. And now we're moving back a little in time. We're going to the years of World War II with Benedict Cumberbatch's rendition of Alan Turing, a truly melancholic thriller directed by the Norwegian Morten Tidlem. This is the story about the cracking of the Enigma code, and it really is a film that divides into three different phases. Phase one is the early schooling or schoolboy years of Alan Turing, which, being in a British public school, which is a private school, had its own moments of barbarity. He then moves on to Cambridge. He becomes a top scientist, mathematician, and, of course, is enrolled at the beginning of World War II with the real issue, the problem of cracking the German code, which is there on the Enigma machine if you can get to the machine and if you can solve the problem. And, of course, this is a World War II where a lot of the commanders were people who remembered the trenches from the First World War, and so they didn't necessarily believe in boffins from Cambridge when what they'd learned to do was to fight with a bayonet. But the setup, which is extremely well filmed, is set at Bletchley Park, which was the head of the code-cracking section in 1939, and Cumberbatch comes in as the kind of odd duck in a team who are set there to do the impossible. In a sense, the movie, I think, is really, really historically accurate in discriminating between the people who fought the war over computers and the people who were essentially fighting in the trenches. Now, I mentioned the film falls into three phases, and phase three takes us up to the 1950s, where he is now back in Manchester and sadly is prosecuted under a extremely different sort of sexual code of behaviour that we know today. So he's prosecuted and is prosecuted on the grounds of a gay liaison, is forced to take a form of what is known as chemical castration, and ends up, although they don't put it clearly in the film, committing suicide through a poisoned apple. I think it's interesting that this was the same method that Socrates would in fact use, another genius of his own time. Some people have even suggested that the use of the apple could be a connection to computers in the future. Certainly, Keira Knightley is the bright girl who, on the side, helps join both the cryptologists because she's good at crossword puzzles, but also there's a sort of tender relationship. So here you have a movie which is about artificial intelligence, it's about wartime code cracking, it's about how a team of really academics are fighting a war that was unknown at that particular time. It's a film about secrecy. And I think the secrets get deeper as the story evolves. Now, we're in that beginning of the run-up to the Oscar season, and I think certainly one of the contenders this year is going to be Benedict Cumberbatch, and I certainly think The Imitation Game will be in there with a number of other interesting movies. Highly recommended, playing in cinemas both in the East Bay in Marin and also here in San Francisco.
Indeed, Peter. I'm hoping to catch that in the next week or so. Now, the new season of Downton Abbey has started. I'm hoping that my own DVR at home was smart enough to record it, because I didn't reprogram it and I missed the first episode, which was this past Sunday. So tell us your perspective on this new season, that eagerly anticipated season of Downton Abbey on PBS.
Well, the good thing about Downton Abbey is nothing changes. But now they're faced with change, because the new season begins in the year 1924. It's the Labour government that has come into power. And that, of course, is the other end of the social spectrum to where the Downton Abbey crew, including Lord Grantham, played by Hugh Bonneville, begin to exist. Will they have death duties? Will the estate be cut down to size? God help us if they have to find a job, actually go to work. So these are all the real issues that come up in this new series, and not least of all is the use of the telephone. Now, I've got to say, the telephone is as confusing to them as the smartphone is to me today, so they effectively have my sympathy. But this really is a story of old world charm meeting modernity. We're looking at what in fact would be the twilight of the British Empire. It's those few years after the end of World War One, and suddenly the world is a different place. Lady Cora, played by Elizabeth McGovern, finds distraction in a visiting art critic, Richard Grant, and then the issue of marriage is still on the spectrum, since the daughter, Lady Mary, is now in pursuit of a new suitor. So as this all comes together, I'm asking myself, is this a cottage industry or is it a castle industry? Mm. And I think its castles are there. Indeed, it reminds me of a couple of Noel Card numbers where he's talking about the English aristocracy going out of style and wondering how to pay for their expenses. I'll finish with this, and I've mentioned it before, but I still think I hark back to an old Gilbert and Sullivan opera where they say to a member of the House of Lords, "Tell me, sir, what do you do?" And he says, "Nothing in particular, but I do it particularly well." And I think that's a quick take on the new series, which has opened this week and will be running for the next month, of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes' piece of costume theatre with a twist.
Downton Abbey. Thank you so much, Peter, for your contribution this week.
Good to be here. Good to see you, David.
Mary, Happy New Year to you.
To you. Happy New Year to everybody. Yes.
Indeed. Well, I think we covered an awful lot of territory on this week's Open Air, from live theater to musical theater to drama at the Eureka Theater to drama on the big screen with Imitation Game, and on the little screen with Downton Abbey. There are a number of excellent concerts coming up this weekend as well that you should be aware of. Interesting production with the San Francisco Symphony, The Godfather Live. The terrific Francis Ford Coppola masterpiece, The Godfather, with Marlon Brando, Al Pacino, accompanied by the live orchestra, Nina Rota's epic score. That's on tomorrow and Saturday at 8. And then a little bit of a breakout moment for some members of the San Francisco Symphony, some chamber music. They're going to be doing some Mozart, some Nikolai Kapustin, Handel, and Dvorak this coming Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, featuring Robin McKee on flute for the trio for flute, cello, and piano of Nikolai Kapustin, and string quartet of Dvorak, number 12 in F major. Again, information for all of the SF Symphony concerts going on at sfsymphony.org. We're also a media sponsor for the St. John Passion, which is being done by the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, directed by Ming Luke, Saturday and at 4:30 and Sunday at 4:30. The concerts are free and features not only the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, but the Berklee High School Concert Chorale, a special guest performance by them. Among the soloists, my good friend Brian Thorsett is singing the tenor role. Jennifer Paulino is a soprano. Danielle Ritter, Hara, mezzo-soprano. Jeffrey Fields, baritone, and Paul Thompson on bass. Under the direction of Ming Luke, music director of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra. I encourage you to do so. We are a media sponsor for that event. And that concludes Open Air for today, the 8th of January, 2015. My producer is Niels Swinkels, who's been herding cats and keeping the calendar straight and has got some wonderful lineups for you as in the month that come ahead. My name is David LaTulipe. You can send me a program suggestion if you've got some group that you'd like to have featured on Open Air. Send me an email, david@kalw.org. A reminder also that all of our programs are archived at the KLW website, kalw.org. Just look for the Open Air tab. Thanks for being with us.